guys, welcome back to the podcast. We're going to kick off with part two of the Natural Born Killers case. And where we left off in episode one, Charlie and Carol, their whole plan to escape was kind of starting to devolve, I think. I think they were in over their heads. And just like Charlie told that gas station clerk, after he bought all these maps and stuff, like, it doesn't really matter where we're going, you know what I mean? I think he didn't really have a very clear plan of what to do next. So, they had spent another day on the road. And after a few hours rest, Charlie and Carol make their way into Wyoming by 1 p.m. Now they were in real cowboy country. The kind of country that Charlie kind of imagined himself being in, like in the movies he watched, out in the Wild West, kind of living like an outlaw. But there was a problem. There were radio reports warning people to be on the lookout for them. And they were also driving in this big, black, ostentatious Packard, which stood out. Two teenagers could never possibly afford a car as big and fancy as this one. Plus, it also had Nebraska license plates, which were very obvious. So, just as soon as they arrive, they quickly leave Douglas in Wyoming, and then they take off on Highway 87 towards Casper, Wyoming. After driving for about 15 miles, Charlie stops the car when he sees a Buick parked on the other side of the road. Charlie gets out and he walks over to the Buick, deciding that he and Carol would need a change of vehicle if they wanted to stay under the radar. Unfortunately, Merrill Collison, the traveling salesman who owned this Buick, was sound asleep in the back seat of his car. Charlie knocks on the window, waking him up, and he tells Merrill, "Unlock the door." Merrill replies, "Why?" Charlie tells him, "We're going to trade cars." But Merrill obviously refuses this really weird request from this stranger he doesn't know. But rather than pick a different car to steal, Charlie walks back to the Packard. He retrieves the .22 pump rifle and he returns to the Buick, firing through the window. Charlie shoots Merrill 9 times through the window. Then he opens the car door and shoots him another 7 times. Charlie then tells Carol to get into the back of the Buick. But in his haste and panic, Charlie can't seem to get the emergency brake to release. And this unsuspecting Good Samaritan comes along the road and offers to help. This guy was named Joe Sprinkle. And he was driving towards Douglas when he sees the two cars parked on the side of the road. He just thought he was doing a good deed, offering to help in case they were having car trouble or something. And he walks up to Charlie from behind. And Charlie immediately swings around with his rifle and sticks it in this guy's face. Charlie said to him, "If you don't get this emergency brake up, I'll kill you." So, as Joe got closer to the Buick, he noticed that Carol was sobbing in the back seat, and he also noticed Merrill Collison's body in the front of the car, and I think he realized he was in a very, very precarious situation. But the thing was, Joe was a 29-year-old man. He was very big and strong, and he wasn't exactly afraid or intimidated by Charlie, so he began wrestling with Charlie in the middle of the highway, trying to get the gun away from him, and he actually manages to pull the gun away from Charlie for a few seconds. Now, just as this is happening, this fight in the middle of the road, Wyoming Deputy Sheriff William Romer just happened to also be driving to Douglas, and he sees these men fighting in the middle of the road, so he pulls over. Carol then bolts out of the Buick and starts running over to the sheriff, shouting, "Save me! I've been held hostage by Charles Starkweather." Now, This is just my opinion because I wasn't there, but I don't think Carol was ever Charlie's hostage. I think that she was his accomplice. And I think that she knew that he was planning, at least in some way, to force her parents into allowing their relationship. I don't know if she knew all of the details or how far he was going to take things, but I think she knew a lot more than she would later pretend. I think that Charlie would use the gun more often in the crimes that were committed, and I feel that Carol used the knife in the situations that we've described already. I'm not going to go into details because some of them are really graphic, but for example, her sister, and I think Carol King, I think Carol was involved in those crimes specifically. I also think she probably had to help Charlie carry her mother and father outside to those outhouses, because I don't see how he could possibly do that himself. He wasn't a very big person. I don't know how he could carry two full adult bodies that were dead weight outside. And, you know, it just seems really unlikely. But anyway, before I get sidetracked, she was screaming at the sheriff that she'd been held hostage. So as soon as Charlie sees Deputy Romer's car, he ran for the stolen Packard. He was like, oh no, they're going to catch me. So he starts running, gets into the Packard, and drives off as fast as he possibly can. Romer then radios the Douglas police station to set up a roadblock, and he takes off after Charlie with Carol sitting beside him in his car. Now, Charlie was driving at about 100 miles per hour, but the Douglas chief of police, Robert Ainsley, and the sheriff of Converse County named Earl Heflin were closing in behind him. And just by happenstance, Charlie suddenly gets slowed down in some traffic. And that allows Ainsley, who was driving, to get in close enough for Heflin to start firing at Charlie's tires with his .38 revolver. Now, you can imagine, all these shots were ringing out. There was this crazy car chase happening. So people were running left, right. They were scattering everywhere, trying to avoid this crazy situation. Cars were literally swerving onto the sidewalk to get out of the way. But Charlie manages to make it out of town, and he gets back out onto the open highway again, back into the direction of Nebraska. So at this point, both he and Ainsley are driving at about 120 miles per hour down this road. Meanwhile, Heflin has decided to change weapon because the .38 caliber revolver wasn't cutting it. So he swaps the revolver for a .30 caliber carbine, and this time he starts shooting at the back window of the Packard. Now, after about two shots of this gun, he actually manages to hit the back window, shattering the glass completely. Now, one of the bullets that shattered the glass seemed to either clip Charlie's ear, or it was a piece of glass from the window that clipped Charlie's ear. Either way, his ear starts pumping blood. And the funny thing is, you know, after he had killed 11 people and terrorized towns and the whole state, this little clip in the ear seemed to be enough to scare Charlie Starkweather, and he came to an immediate stop in the middle of the road, just like that. After all that, after all this, you know, bedlam, all these manhunts, all these car chases, all these escape plans, that one little clip in the ear seemed to like just make him immediately jump on the brakes. So he stops in the middle of the road, and Heflin and Ainsley, they stop about 100 feet behind him, and they wait for him to exit the car because they know that he's still armed and he's still dangerous, even if he is stopping his car. So they yell at him to put his hands up, but Charlie refuses. So Ainsley fires a shot at the ground near Charlie's feet. Then Charlie begins to reach for something in the waist of his pants. So Ainsley fires another warning shot, and this time Heflin shouts for him to get his hands up, And Charlie ignores him again, and he goes about, like, tucking his shirt into his pants as leisurely as he likes until he's satisfied, and then he just turns around and lays face down on the highway, just showing how, like, cocky and vain he was up to the very last second. Even though he knew he was caught, he wasn't going to go on their terms. He had to find some way to rebel against what he was being told to do. After that, Charlie is handcuffed and brought to Douglas Jail, where he tells Heflin to loosen the handcuffs or he won't tell him anything. Then he said, and again, this just shows how cocky he is and obnoxious, quote, "You wouldn't have caught me if I hadn't stopped. If I'd had a gun, I would have shot you." Then he asked for a pen and paper so he could write some letters to his parents. Now, after a bit of jurisdictional wrangling between Wyoming and the Nebraska lawmen, there was kind of a whole issue between them because obviously Charlie had committed murders in both states, but he was arrested. Like, he started in Nebraska, but he was arrested in Wyoming. Wyoming kind of wanted to hold on to him. Nebraska was saying, "We want him back." Eventually, this whole custody issue was settled when the Wyoming governor, a man named Millward Simpson, said that he would never grant the death penalty, but he would be willing to hand him over to Nebraska, which wasn't objecting to the death penalty. So he was like, well, I personally won't sentence him to death, but I will send him to Nebraska where he can be sentenced to death. So it kind of worked out. Whatever weird reason, Charlie and Carol both refuse to fly back to Nebraska, so instead they have to be driven in separate cars to Nebraska in this 4-car caravan. And while Carol was in the car with Sheriff Carnop's wife, a lady named Gertrude Carnop, she remarked to Gertrude, "Isn't this a nice coat?" It was the coat that she had stolen from Clara Ward after they murdered her. Now, finally, Charlie, who was in custody, and, you know, despite Carol's whole story about being his unwilling hostage, they were both charged with first-degree murder, and they were returned to Lincoln. I don't know why that was such a hard thing to say. Carol would spend the next 9 months in the maximum security section of the state mental hospital because it was the only place deemed safe enough for a juvenile female convicted of first-degree murder. They had no place else to put her. They couldn't put her into a prison. It was literally this mental hospital. That was the only place that they could detain her safely. On January 31st, early in the morning, Charlie gives his second confession. He wrote, quote, "Carol is the one who said to go to Washington State. By the time anybody will read this, I will be dead for all the killings. Then they cannot give Carol the chair too. From Lincoln, Nebraska, they got us on January 29th, 1958. Kill 11 persons. Charlie kill 9, all men. Carol kill 2, all girls." At the bottom, he drew a heart with an arrow through it. Inside the heart was the names Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugate. On February 12th, John MacArthur is appointed by Judge Harry Spencer to defend Carol Ann Fugate. And MacArthur tries to file a writ of prohibition, which would have basically meant that Carol's case would be transferred to a juvenile court. On the 10th of March, Clement Gaughan is chosen to defend Charlie in court. And the district court denies the writ of prohibition for Carol's case, so she wasn't going to be allowed to be tried as a juvenile. On May the 5th, Charlie Starkweather's trial begins, and he arrives to court in a tan suit and tie. MacArthur refuses to allow Carol to testify, saying that she'll just invoke her Fifth Amendment if she is called to testify against Charlie. There were huge crowds assembled outside the courthouse for a glimpse at the infamous teenage couple, and there was such a intense feeling of concern for security that there actually had to be armed guards posted in key places. There were, like, plainclothes police officers in the crowds, all in case people started to get out of control or anybody did anything violent. And, you know, that was to be expected with something this crazy. So now, just to show how clueless Charlie was, or maybe, again, overly self-confident, he decided that he wanted to give himself this defense that he had killed all these people in an act of self-defense. Now, I can understand killing one person in self-defense. That could be believable. But 11 people? Including a 2-year-old? Like, how was he going to spin the story that Betty Jean was a threat to his life? You know what I mean? I don't know. Unfortunately, at the same time, Charlie was being idolized as some kind of teen heartthrob celebrity, and he was hamming it up for the crowds and the cameras, and he loved all the attention. Like, it was kind of like Ted Bundy, this weird, the way women would have like this weird sick fascination with him, and like talk about how handsome he was, and, you know, just ignore the fact that he was a monster. Charlie would have his hair done. Sometimes he would wear kind of dressy suits, or he would kind of lean into the James Dean look at court with the black leather jacket, and he would have the cigarette kind of tossed out the side of his mouth. Now, as we said, even though his defense makes no sense, it's clear on some level that Charlie was trying to minimize what he had done, or possibly even remove himself from it psychologically. Maybe finally he was sensing the gravity of his awful actions. And it also shows that, you know, this fantasy life that he was living in, being a rebel and a cowboy and kind of facing no consequences, I don't think he ever thought he would get caught for what he was doing. Over 3 days, the prosecutor, named Elmer Scheel, presented their case against Charlie. They made the choice to try him for just one of the 11 murders, and that was the murder of Robert Jensen Jr. in Bennett, because that was the case where they had won the most witnesses and they had the most kind of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. For this trial, the following people were brought in to testify: Robert Jensen Sr., who was Bobby's father, Warren King, the brother of Carol King, his girlfriend, who had died too, Homer Tate, who was the owner of Tate's gas station, Howard Ganucci, the farmer who helped Charlie get the car out of the mud, Everett Browning, the farmer who heard the shots and the one who found the bodies in the storm cellar, and Dr. Irwin Zeman, who was a pathologist. Scheel went to work establishing all the links between Charlie and the murders, and he interviewed numerous police and deputies, and he also read Charlie's own statements in court. The state rested its case against Charlie on May the 13th. The next day, Clem Gaughan begins his defense of Charlie, and he begins by having multiple people testify about a blow to the head Charlie received some time ago while he was at work. Then Guy and Helen Starkweather were scheduled to testify for their son's defense, but Guy actually doesn't show up. Then Dr. Nathan Greenbaum, Dr. John O'Hearn, and Dr. John Steinman were called to describe Charlie's mental state. After that, the defense rested its case, and on May 22nd, the jury brings in a verdict of first-degree murder on both of the two counts, and they specify the death penalty. No one doubted Charlie's guilt, but there were some questions of Carol's guilt. Now, initially, we know Carol was claiming to be a hostage, and she was putting the blame for everything on Charlie. And at first, Charlie had said that she was innocent. He even told the police not to be rough with Carol, since that she had nothing to do with any of it. They had clearly cooked up some kind of a story together to get her off. But almost immediately, Charlie began backtracking as soon as their story wasn't believed, and as soon as Carol started telling everybody that Charlie was crazy, he really didn't like that at all. He stated that Carol was the murderer of Carol King and Betty Jean Bartlett. In his statement, he said, quote, "I'll be convicted for what I did, and that's okay, but I'll be damned if I'll be sentenced for what I didn't do." He also told reporters if he was going to die by the electric chair, Carol deserved to be sitting right there with him on his lap. So Charlie began giving his statements and his events to the police. And he also underwent lie detector tests, which verified his accounts. Even though the results weren't admissible as evidence in court, it showed to the investigators that he was telling them the truth in his series of events. On the 27th of October, Carol's trial begins. 7 men and 5 women were chosen to sit on the jury. Now, Carol's trial was a bit more complex, and many more people were brought in to testify, including Robert Jensen Sr. again, Warren King, Dr. Zeman, who was the pathologist, Everett Browning, Rodney Starkweather. There were various gas station and restaurant employees that served Carol along the killing spree, various police officers, and maybe most importantly, Deputy Sheriff Bill Romer. At the trial, the trip that she shared to the jail with Sheriff Deputy Romer was described in detail. During this trip, she tells Romer that she and her family were Charlie's hostages. That's right. Even up until that point, she was pretending, until her very arrest, that she did not know her family was dead. But that's when she makes her biggest mistake. She keeps talking and she keeps saying that she was held hostage and that she had seen all 9 murders. Now, let's remember, she wasn't with Charlie when he first murdered the Crest gas station attendant Robert Culvert. 10 people after Culvert died, including 3 members of her own family. And she said she saw 9 murders. The math doesn't add up. Somehow, she wanted people to believe that she thought her family was still alive. And they also knew about these clippings, these like newspaper article clippings that she had cut out. These were article clippings about her own family, about her family's murder, about all the other victims. There is no possible way that she did not know they were dead. She'd caught herself in a lie, and everyone at the court saw her for the liar that she was. The things that she said to Romer in the car, the whole statement, his testimony, it pretty much destroyed her entire hostage case at court. It's also worth noting that in all the time that she was in custody during the trial, she never exhibited any of the usual behavior of a traumatized victim, or how you would imagine a 14-year-old girl who had lost her entire family and supposedly witnessed the murder of 7 other innocent people would act. Now, we can't predict how people will act when they're upset, but Carol definitely exhibited no real signs of trauma, sadness, fear, nothing. She never talked about how Charlie managed to keep her as his hostage, and she never talked about being his victim unless she had an audience listening to her. And according to the sheriff's wife, who was responsible for the care of Carol during the trial, she maintained that Carol was actually the brains of the couple. Now, Charlie testified against Carol in court. Carol thought that Charlie was trying to implicate her in the crimes because he had kind of hated her from the second that she ran towards the sheriff and ran away from him. She thought that he was trying to make it look like she was as guilty as he was. However, Carol's demeanor and attitude in court didn't garner her any sympathy at all. When she would speak, her mouth was always in a firm line. She appeared to be very confident, very headstrong, sometimes downright defiant, and not at all like the damaged, meek victim that her defense team was trying to portray her as. When she was asked in an interview if she was worried about being found guilty at all, she said, "I don't really have anything to worry about. The Lord knows I'm innocent." Robert Jensen described Carol as the most defiant person he had ever seen. He didn't see any remorse in her at all for her part in the killing of his son. Then on November 10th, Carol's own statement was read out loud, where she admits she held a gun on Bobby Jensen and she also took his wallet. On November 12th, the state rests its case. MacArthur begins defending Carol by having Macy Moore, who was an aide at the state hospital, and Pansy Street, who was her maternal grandmother, testify for her, as well as Edwin Coates, who was a psychiatrist, and multiple other people. On November 20th, the jury begins deliberations, and the following day, they give the guilty verdict on the second count, which was murder while in the perpetration of a robbery. The jury decided, however, that Carol, who was only 15 at the time, should be sentenced to life imprisonment, rejecting the death penalty because of her age. Now, as I mentioned, Carol, who was very unemotional throughout the whole trial, finally broke down in tears when she heard the verdict. It was the only time she ever showed any kind of emotion or cried or anything, despite everything that happened, despite her family's murder, everything else. That was the only time she cried, was when she cried for herself. She was the youngest woman in the United States to be sentenced to life imprisonment. I think it's easy to forget how it feels to be 19 or 14, and how stifling your life can feel, and how angry and frustrating it can be, and how much you hate your teachers, or you hate your parents, or you hate your siblings for various petty reasons. But at the same time, to you, they feel like the worst things in the world. At some stage, we've probably all been guilty of saying, "I hate so-and-so, I wish they'd drop dead." But we don't act on those thoughts. We can regulate our emotions and recognize that we would feel guilty, or it would be wrong if that actually did happen to someone. But in people like Carol and Charlie, they don't have that regulation. They don't have the ability to put the brakes on and stop themselves. It seems like there was some kind of change in Charlie in his adolescence, where he adopted this bad boy, dangerous behavior, and he let all of that take over him. And Carol, she was a willing participant in everything that he did. They shared a fantasy where their violence was acceptable and maybe even desirable to each other. As a teenager, you spend so long searching for yourself in the people you spend time with, in your friends, in your boyfriend, in your girlfriend. And unfortunately, Charlie and Carol found their sense of self in murder. They had no remorse. And if they hadn't been stopped in Wyoming, they probably would have kept on murdering more people. In the space of less than 2 months, 11 innocent people lost their lives in brutal, horrible ways, and it literally sent shockwaves through the whole country that two, basically children, had done all of this. Despite all the terrible things they did, just like with Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger, people romanticized all of the couple's deeds, and they inspired the films Badlands and Natural Born Killers, as well as the TV show Murder in the Heartland, and even a whole Bruce Springsteen song titled Nebraska. Charlie was scheduled for execution on the 22nd of May in 1959. Carol sends a telegram to President Eisenhower to try and enlist his help and asks him to visit Charlie before his execution. She was given an immediate reply saying Charlie's execution was a state matter and the president had no authority in the matter at all. Probably more likely, he had no interest in the matter. Now, if you thought Carol did this out of love or concern for Charlie, the answer is no. Her only reason for wanting his death sentence to be changed was on the off chance that he decided to change his mind and defend her innocence once again. So, the 22nd comes around. It's 6 a.m., and Robert Jensen Sr. is waiting to get the news of Charlie's execution, while he stands next to his son's grave, listening out for the news on the car radio. It comes as a terrible shock when Charlie suddenly receives a stay of execution from federal judge Rich Robinson, who was contacted by Guy Starkweather. But Charlie wouldn't be able to avoid death for long. On June 25th, Charlie's head and left leg were shaved. A huge group of about 70 teenagers begin driving around the Nebraska State Penitentiary, playing rock music and shouting about Charlie's death and, you know, making a whole scene. And at midnight, the 19-year-old serial murderer, Charles Starkweather, is led to the electric chair. He still didn't show a shred of fear or remorse, and he was strapped into the chair and received 2,000 volts of electricity 3 times and died. In June 1972, NBC News makes a documentary about Carol's experience titled Growing Up in Prison. It's quite shocking to see her in the documentary. I watched the whole thing. At that point, she was a 29-year-old woman. She has a big, styled beehive hairdo. She's wearing black horn-rimmed glasses, and she actually looks very fashionable for the time, and you'd never even know she was a prisoner. She says she survived in prison just by getting through 1 year at a time, saying if she thought she was doomed to life in the penitentiary, she wouldn't have made it. In the documentary, Bobby Jensen's mother, who had since her son's murder and the trial had become a recluse, she was interviewed and she says it seems like not a single day has gone by, never mind 14 years since Bobby and Carol died. She actually has photos of Bobby and his beloved Carol side by side on her mantle where she could see them both. Carol said, quote, "It's something that will always be with me. It's something that I will always carry with me, and I've learned to accept it, and it lives in the back of my mind. It's behind a little door, and right now, the past is over with. There's nothing I can do. I can't change it. I have to make now, today, tomorrow, and my future. There's no way to go back, and if there's any way humanly possible that I could go back, and I could change what happened, if I could in any way bring back those people, give them back their life that he took, if there was anything I could do, I would, but there's just nothing I can do. It's over with." Carol was still claiming her innocence. She said she was forced to go with Charlie, and she begged the police for a lie detector test and truth serum to prove that she was telling the truth. She said Charlie forced her to go along with him by saying if she refused, he would kill her family, still maintaining that she didn't know they were already dead on the property. She said she didn't know they were dead until she was in custody and returned to Nebraska. She calls Charlie a madman, and she said, quote, "People don't really realize I lost my family too." But even though she said this, and she said how sorry she was, and she said all the right things, just like in 1958, she was still completely cold and unfeeling. Her eyes were still lifeless. She described her misery and loneliness in the first months of solitary confinement in prison. She was in confinement because she wasn't allowed to enter general population until she was 16 years old. She said it was hard to grow up without a mother, and it's hard to grow up without a father. She described how hard it is in prison, seeing other girls be visited by their families, and she said to herself, "Gee, I wish I had a family to visit me." Well, maybe if you hadn't helped your boyfriend murder your family, you wouldn't have to worry about that, Carol. Mind you, she was at a prison that allowed women to wear their own clothes, take college courses, go to the town swimming pool 2 mornings a week, and if they earned the warden's trust, they could go to the bowling alley in town and get local jobs. From what I saw of the footage of Carol in prison, she had a lovely time with many privileges. She actually learned how to swim while she was in prison. She became a great bowler, and she even became a baptized Roman Catholic and volunteered at the local church's nursery, taking care of the congregant's small children and babies while they sat at Mass. Many people began to believe Carol deserved another chance to prove herself in society. The governor himself felt that she had been rehabilitated. After many motions for a new trial, eventually in June of 1973, Carol is granted a parole hearing with the Nebraska Parole Board. After spending only 18 years in prison, Carol Fugate was released in 1976, still maintaining her innocence, despite Bobby Jensen's parents' major disapproval. She has never taken responsibility for any of her actions. After leaving prison, Carol moved to Michigan and she worked as a hospital orderly at the Ingham Regional Medical Center in Lansing for 20 years. She also worked as a babysitter. Carol got married in 2007 and she began going by her husband's last name, Carol Clare. Her two passions were watching TV and playing slot machines, which was actually how she met her husband, Fred. She also shares 4 stepsons with her husband, who later died in a car crash. In 2020, Carol is still pleading her case, this time actually demanding a pardon from the Nebraska Board of Pardons. She wrote in her pardon application, quote, "The idea that posterity has been made to believe that I willingly participated in a murder spree is too much for me to bear." Tom King, who is the nephew of Carol King, said of this whole pardon application, "She should just keep her mouth shut. We don't want to hear about it anymore. It just brings up hard feelings all over again. She better not come back to Lincoln. If she does, she may not make it back out of town." So, that's the end of today's case, guys. You'll have to tell me in the comments what you think. I'm most interested to hear what you think of Carol and her whole claim of being an innocent hostage, actually describing herself as one of Charlie's victims. And it's worth noting that apparently this year there's going to be a new documentary all about Carol coming out called The 12th Victim. And it's basically Carol's portrayal of how she was victimized by Charlie and also taken advantage of by the state. So let me know if you're going to watch that documentary. Let me know what you thought of the case. I'm not sure if I'll watch the documentary because I watched that whole NBC documentary with Carol and I don't know. I feel like I can't quite stomach her victim angle. I don't know. It's a tough one because I can see why people do sympathize with her because she was so young when all of this happened. But from everything I've seen, Carol was very clever, very confident, very self-assured, even though she was young. And I think there is something to the idea that she was the smarter of the two. And I don't know. I just find it very hard to believe that she was just an innocent bystander in it all, especially in her own family situation. It doesn't make sense to me. So, again, I've given you as many of the facts as I can. Let me know what you think. I'm very interested. And I'll talk to you guys in the next episode. Bye!